for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 437 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is another doubleheader episode, and it starts out with a great interview with Rich Davis, the writer and creator of The Cult of Dracula from Second Sight Publishing. We talk about this book and how it came to be, as well as the really interesting take that Rich has on the Dracula legend, something I think you're really going to enjoy. Then everything wraps up with Tyler Chin Tanner's return, and he's talking about the latest Kickstarter from A Wave Blue World, which is called Maybe Someday. We recorded this early in the Kickstarter, so be sure to listen and go and support this wonderful book after you listen to this interview. This is a follow-up to another successful anthology that they've had, and it's a very positive and uplifting one. So I think you're really going to enjoy what Tyler and his group all have created, and that's what we talk about during this interview. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Rich Davis, the writer and creator of a new comic called Cult of Dracula, which is inspired by characters created by Bram Stoker. I always get that name wrong. But hope I don't get Rich Davis's name wrong, thankfully. How are you doing, Rich?
Man, I am doing so much better than I deserve. I am very happy to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you. I've got so many questions about this book. You let me read some of it, yeah, which I appreciate. And I'm fascinated because I'm not much of a horror guy, I have to admit. However, I've gotten more and more into horror as I've gone along. I was just doing a thing for somebody about Joe Hill's book called The Cape.
Oh.
I don't know if you've ever read it. It was it's what if superheroes were bad?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody got a superpower of flight, and thank God that's all he got.
Right.
Because he does terrible things.
I love Joe Hill. He is such a fantastic writer. He really is.
So I was talking about that, and I was saying I'm kind of coming around to it. The thing you got to be careful about is don't spoil stuff, because mm-hmm. this big surprise is coming. And I desperately don't want people to be, you know, to spoil these things, because then you don't get the same thrill that I did when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Cult of Dracula. Now, the first thing I want to get into, because this is kind of interesting to me, you're the first release of a horror line of a company that I haven't heard of before. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's called Second Sight Studios, and they're a fairly new company out on their own, but they've been releasing comics for many years, mostly with Caliber Comics and Antarctic Press. It's founded by Bradley Golden and Marcus Roberts and Spike Jarrell. A couple of names that some of the listeners may recognize if they pick up any indie and small press comics. Bradley is known most for books like These Damn Kids and Leave the Lights On and a couple of horror anthologies. So Second Sight is a pretty well-accomplished team of horror writers, and they've decided to kind of strike out on their own and start a new small press label called Second Sight Studios. And I am very honored to be a part of that, and I'm very happy that they've chosen Cult of Dracula to be their premier flagship book on their new horror line called Second Sight Presents.
Have they done other books? Is this the first book? Because I haven't heard of them before, so I'm just trying to figure out. They've done other books besides yours?
This will be the first one for Second Sight Studios, but the creative teams, Spike and Bradley and Marcus, they are all accomplished comics creators in their own right. So they've been working primarily with Caliber Comics, Antarctic Press, things like that. Spike has self-published a few things. He's got a new book coming out soon called Lady Freedom that's pretty exciting. And Bradley has recently optioned a few of his horror books to be adapted into feature films with an Australian company called Spirit Rider Productions, which is really cool. So you've probably never heard of Second Sight Studios before, but hopefully after Cult of Dracula hits comic book store shelves, you will hear about them often.
Oh, good. Okay, that'd be something to see. Because I'm always interested in new companies because, you know, I always say this, that established companies can't take chances.
Right.
I always say Batman has to come back to where he was or else somebody else can't pick up the character the next time and do another story, and that person has to go back to where they was.
Yeah, there's a certain freedom in being a small press company and being creator-owned, focused, because you can tell more unique stories. You don't have to be confined by, you know, decades and decades and decades of continuity. And you're absolutely correct. You know, the small press studio can really they can afford to take a gamble with their properties and, you know, try to tell stories in a new and innovative way. And I really think that we're coming into a time in comic books where that creativity and ingenuity is coming back into vogue. You know, it was really prominent in the late 80s and early 90s when you had your Vertigo and things like that being born. And, you know, there were so many indie labels producing so many really cool genre comics. And then that kind of went away for a while and everything was dominated by Marvel and DC. And now I think there's a hunger for these small press, you know, indie books now, these different types of stories that are told in different genres like horror and sci-fi and fantasy. So I think Second Sight is really kind of striking while the iron's hot, and I think they're ready to make their mark.
And of course, this is a good time because comics are coming back to life after a forced time off, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So now everything's starting to come out. Now, but you guys have been working on this for a while now. This is just coming to hit the public eye. So
right.
Talk about, you know, how long you guys been working on this?
I've been working on Cult of Dracula in one form or another since 2013. It began as a stage play, and it was produced at the Brown Coat Pub and Theater in Wilmington, North Carolina. It was an award-winning stage play, did very, very well. And that stage play happened to be seen by a good friend of mine named Tony Todd, who most of the listeners will recognize from The Candyman or Star Trek. And Tony was very supportive of me adapting this stage play into a screenplay. And our goal was to produce it as an independent feature film. And so we worked on that for a while, and things happened. Tony got really busy, and I decided, you know, I can produce this as a comic book. And I started working on that. My friend Georges Genty got involved and was very encouraging. So we started adapting it for a comic book around 2016. And then, you know, that's kind of took off from there. So yeah, it's been a long road to get where we are, but you know, it's, I think all that work and effort has been worth it.
Because, mm-hmm, you know, vampires have been around for a long time. And of course, we had the teenage vampire stuff for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And all those. And I always have to ask people, what's new that you can do with vampires? Well, you sent me like a release of some sorts. And there's a paragraph in there, I think, answers that question. And with your permission, I'll go ahead and read this. Cause
please do.
If you think that this is going to be regular Dracula, I've got a paragraph here that's going to change your mind on that. This is, the story reimagines the classic Dracula myth within the confines of a Manson family-inspired cult. It's witchy, it's weird, it's helter-skelter within a hippie cult dedicated to an ancient blood goddess. You may know Bram Stoker's genre-defining classic by heart, but you have no idea where Cult of Dracula will take you. It explores vampire, the mythologies of many different cultures from around the world and throughout human history. The book is as much about pagan cults, the occult, and pagan culture as it is about vampires. Now that I haven't read before.
That is absolutely true. I have been a fan of vampires since I was a small child. I was a little bit weird as a kid. I love to read stories about vampires. They've always fascinated me. And I have never read a story quite like Cult of Dracula. And that was one of the things that Georges Genty initially challenged me with when I gave him the first draft of the comic script. He said, "It's good." He said, "I love your dialogue. I love how you set up the scenes. I love your structure, but it was kind of paint by numbers as far as vampire stories go." He said, "What are you doing to change the vampire mythology?" And we started talking about 30 Days of Night and how successful it was, because for the first time, it was built on the question, what if the vampires didn't have to sleep during the day? What if they had 30 days to just run amok? What would happen? And it completely changed how we look at vampires, and it told us a completely unique story. So I started thinking about what could I do to make Cult of Dracula different, to make it stand out from other books in the vampire genre. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board a bit, started doing my research, and I really started delving into vampire mythologies from different cultures around the world and throughout human history. And I kept coming up with this one common theme that just kept appearing in culture after culture, mythology after mythology. It was always there. And, you know, cultures that never crossed paths, they existed, you know, hundreds or thousands of years apart, or, you know, sometimes tens of thousands of miles apart. And this same common story kept reappearing. And it was all about a dark outcast woman who was cursed to walk the night and steal children from their cribs. And, you know, in modern pop culture, of course, you know, you immediately think of La Llorona, and you think of the Baba Roga, and you can start delving deeply into that, and you get back to the Lamia and Lamashtu and even Medusa. And even you can tie this all the way back to the biblical stories of Lilith. Everyone knows the story of Lilith being Adam's first bride who refused to lie down. And so she was kicked out of Eden, and then Eve was created. But if you go into the Jewish Kabbalah and you read more of Lilith's story, you find out that Lilith went and lived in a cave and was living a very happy life. And God sent angels to her and to offer her a deal, say, you know, "Lilith, I'll forgive everything. Just please come back." And Lilith refused. She said, "No, I'm happy. I'm living my life and having children and doing my thing." And the angels got angry and they cursed Lilith. And to survive, Lilith had to devour 1,000 of her children every single day to survive. And so that kind of became the genesis of this idea for where we end up taking Cult of Dracula. Dracula becomes more of a title in our book. It's passed down through the generations, through a matriarchal line of succession. And so, and it all dates back to this blood cult dedicated to Lilith. And that opened up a whole new world of stories that we could tell, and we could tell them from a unique perspective that people aren't expecting and people have never seen before. So I think it's going to carry the vampire genre forward in a very positive and interesting way.
See, I'm interested because you didn't call it Cult of Lilith. You call it Cult of Dracula, which is kind of interesting. So I'm trying to figure how this is going to, I get the interesting story about it, but is you're saying that Dracula is more of a title-y thing than more of a, he's actually going to show up kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There have been many Dracula in our world, and this just the Dracula that we meet in this world just happens to be one of those. And there's a story about why this particular Dracula, this particular Dracula is here at this place at this time with these people. And that becomes what's important because, the story of Dracula has been told and retold and reimagined and spoofed and made fun of so many times that in some ways it's lost its impact. And you really can't tell an effective story about a weird, eccentric foreigner, aristocrat anymore and make it scary because we've made fun of that too much. And we've seen too many comedies, Leslie Nielsen and all those people doing excellent, comedic takes on Dracula. And then, of course, you have all the kind of unintentionally humorous Hammer films from the 70s, and so the eccentric aristocrat really doesn't resonate with a modern audience. But, we can look at different things that stalk the night, outcast people. And I think that stays true to Bram Stoker's original intent because, Dracula was the other, that was the fear in the Victorian time. The other is going to come in and mess our entire world up. So we still look at the other in this script, but we look at the other from a different perspective. It's not a foreign aristocrat, eccentric gentleman. It's an outcast woman who has had things forced upon her, but chooses to, rather than be a victim, kind of seize her destiny.
Because, first thing that gets me, attracts my attention. I have people who listen to this podcast know this. I have a big thing about female lead characters.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've done is you've changed Dracula from being a male lead to a female lead, which right away, in my mind, opens up a whole number of things that you can do differently than we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited about that. I'm fascinated to see, because I say this on this podcast all the time, it's so true. We have explored men for decades.
Yes.
We know exactly. I mean, we've done everything from scoundrels to scientists to everything, you name it. We've explored men, but the female of the species, I think, is largely still unexplored. And I think one of the things that makes you really interested is to hear what you're going to be doing from the female perspective about this character, because a female Dracula, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interesting power dynamics that we get to explore, and we get to explore the concepts of female agency. Of course, it's also very interesting that I'm the person telling this story, being, a white male, looking at female agency and the female power dynamic. So, really sometimes you're going to see this. It's really interesting to see how the side characters look at and view the powerful, woman being in control of what goes on and how they react to women taking charge of their own destiny and taking agency in the things that happen. The one thing that I can promise anyone listening here is there is no damsel in distress in this story. There is no innocent ingenue who needs saving. And everyone makes their own choices, male, female, or other. They make their own choices and they deal with their own consequences in their own way. So that's another way that I wanted to try to look at this differently and kind of reject some of those traditional tropes that you find in horror a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to me about this because I'm going to be fascinated to see how you approach things, because it's automatically going to be different in my mind. It's going to be something, like I said, I haven't seen before. And that I'm always interested in that. I'm always seeing where we're going to go someplace where I haven't been, because I've been reading stuff like this for a long time, and to go someplace new is very exciting to me. And so I'm fascinated to see where you're going to go.
I can't wait until you get to read it.
Because the first issue, and now we need to talk a little bit about format and stuff like sure. that, too. Do you know how many issues you're going to put out of Cult of Dracula?
Yeah, we are. The series is initially planned for 15 issues. It's going to be 3 5-issue volumes. So the first 5 issues will be out this year in 2019. They'll start actually in early August. They'll hit store shelves. And so we'll have 5 monthly issues, which tell the first volume. And then sometime in early to mid 2020, we'll release issue 6, which will start the second volume. It'll be 5 issues. And then there will be a third volume following that, probably in 2021. Is kind of the calendar that we're looking at, late 2021. That's the initial plan. But as I've been writing, I'm currently in the middle of writing the script for issue 8. So I'm in the middle of the second volume right now, and I'm starting to see how I can open the world up and tell more stories. So if the sales justify it and the fans are there and the audience wants more, there are lots of side stories and things that we can explore to maybe bring this up to maybe 24 issues. I don't really see it going too far beyond that. I don't want to, you know, I would rather leave the story a couple of issues too early then drag it on a couple of issues too late. There's plenty of stories we can tell, but right now 15 issues are planned.
Okay. That'll be good. Cause, normally I always think of the Lost TV show. Mm-hmm. They did the season and they thought they would tell a season and it would be over with. And then suddenly they were a success.
Right.
And they had to come up with more stories, you know, and I hate to say it, but after that first season, it wasn't the same show.
Yeah. It lost some of its luster. I have to agree with you.
To be punny. Yeah. They lost its luster after that. The thing with I like it when somebody has something planned ahead. Mm-hmm. It's like getting in a car. You get in a car and you can wander around and get nowhere and drive for hours. But you know, you're not going anywhere. But if you get in a car and you're going somewhere, there's a sense of purpose. You're trying to get someplace. Every move you make takes you closer to the end,
right?
The conclusion. And so that's the kind of thing that I like, the writing that I enjoy. I always look back at Marv Wolfman and George Perez's Teen Titans.
Yes.
Because they did that extremely well. I mean, you knew they were heading somewhere. Many times I didn't know where it was, but I was excited to get there.
Because every issue carried you forward. And a modern example of that would be Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples. You know, it's always been planned to be 108 issues. And they have done such a brilliant job with that. Or Brian Azzarello's 100 Bullets. I'm like you. I love a story that's been planned out and mapped out, but also allows the characters within it to live and breathe and tell their stories in a realistic, believable way. I hope that I can kind of bridge those two worlds here with Cult of Dracula.
Well, if the first issue is any example of it, I think it's just got some really fascinating twists and turns. Even within the first issue, I was surprised by. And so I just know that there's more coming. So, but I want to talk a little bit more about, before we get into the book, about this thing. Is this second site going to be in Diamond?
Yes, we are currently, we're working on distributing the book through Previews, but as you know, COVID has kind of flipped the entire world upside down, so it's a little more difficult to get a new book into Diamond than it used to be. So what's probably going to happen is Diamond is going to come a little bit later. Right now, we're distributing through a company called Cornerbox, and they're backed by Ingram, which Ingram's been around for many, many years, do a fine job distributing books. But Cornerbox is kind of, it's kind of a new way of small press publishers reaching the direct comics market, because comic book store owners can kind of cut the middleman out and buy almost direct from the publisher. And that allows us, and this is actually one of the reasons why I chose to go with Second Sight over some of the other small press publishers, because we had offers on the table from a couple of different imprints that really were interested in the book. But we chose to go with Second Sight, first because they were very, very passionate about the book and they had a very strong marketing plan for it, but also because they were trying to be innovative and find new ways of reaching the comic book market. So Cornerbox allows us to be very, very aggressive with our pricing. The way Diamonds set up, we were almost going to be forced to raise the price of the book to $3.99, which we were very vehement that we wanted to keep it at $2.99 so that it's accessible to as many readers as possible. But also, Cornerbox is going to allow us to offer some very, very aggressive pricing to our local comic book shop owners out there so that they can actually be profitable by carrying this brand new book. We're going to be offering them a base 50 discount on the book, which is pretty much unheard of for an independent comic. They're going to get a base 50% discount for, you know, if they, no matter how many copies they order. And then if they commit to ordering at least 20 copies of issues 1 through 5, we're going to be able to give them an extra 10% discount on that. So that's going to increase their margins and make them more profitable and hopefully encourage them to buy more copies of the book and put it in more readers' hands. Because we really, really want to support the local comic book shop direct market, because that is the heart and soul of the comic book industry. And if we can get those comic book shop owners talking about the book, then, you know, everything else is going to take care of itself. You know, so if we want them to take care of us, we're going to do everything in our power to take care of them.
Okay, so if somebody wants to learn more about this, is there a place they can go to find out about this?
Absolutely. We've got a Facebook page set up called Cult of Dracula Comic. So if you do Facebook, we'd love it if you would search that and like us. You're going to get all the most up-to-date news before anybody else does. You get to see you know, cover art and sketches and behind-the-scenes videos there first. You can also go to secondsightstudios.com and see what the company is doing. And then, of course, if you're a retailer, we want you to go to Cornerbox. That's corner-box.com. Set up a free account with them, and that would be that's the best place for a retailer to order it, because that's where you're going to get the best pricing on the comic.
Right. Some people get mad at me because I never get to that until the end of the episode. So I'm trying to do it earlier in the procedure. So,
yeah.
So now what I really want to do is get in and talk about the book. Let's talk about the story.
Sure.
Because it starts out interestingly. You know, writers always feel they have to write dialogue in order to prove their existence. And you prove you don't need to do that in the beginning of this book.
Which I think you got 7 pages with not a single word said.
Which, you know, some writers out there I can hear are already struggling, going, oh, no, you know, write dialogue on a page. What's that going to be? But you've already written the story. You've set the whole setup is done already. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the characters all developed and stuff like that. So sometimes they always say that sometimes it's best just to let the art tell the story. And mm-hmm. You obviously believe in the art.
Absolutely.
Let that happen. So talk about that, because like I said, there's some writers out there that won't let that happen. I mean, I look on a page and I often see blobs of text that dominate the art so much. And I look at it and I kind of go, oh, I can't read all that. I'll go to the next page and see what they say. Talk about going this route and as a writer, what that meant to you.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in two ways on that. One, I come from a screenwriting background. And so, you know, I'm accustomed to writing for a director of photography and allowing the camera to tell the story, more so than sometimes the dialogue. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to team up with Henry Martinez. People might recognize him from Ghost Rider, Spirits of Vengeance, Blaze. He did a lot of work for Marvel on those books. And Henry has a very cinematic style to his art and the way he lays his panels out. And so as a writer, the most wonderful gift I was given was to have an artist that I could completely trust with the story. He was able to translate my descriptions and the things that I wanted to see into the panel. And he could tell a story that says, picture says 1,000 words. Well, Henry was able to squeeze an extra 500 words into each panel. So our pictures tell 1,500 words. And that's all because Henry and I have developed a really wonderful working relationship that's built on trust and dependability. And we speak the same language. We see things the same way. And, it just worked out so very, very well. But, you know, there are times when I was tempted to want to throw in, you know, an expositional box in there to maybe say what Brahm is thinking in this moment, or kind of set the scene and tell, like, you know, at this time, 10 years ago, there was blah, 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 blah. But I didn't need to do that because I knew Henry could convey that mood with his art. And he did, you know, and we really do. We open up the first 7 full pages of the book, there's not a single word spoken. And maybe in the entire first scene, I think there's only one character that speaks, and it's just, it's a coroner who happens to be giving a crime report as our main character, Brahm, walks through and assesses a crime scene. But our main character, he actually doesn't speak until, maybe issue 2.
Really?
Yeah. So we don't hear a word out of his mouth until the second issue.
Wow. Okay. See, that's different. I'm saying that right now. That is very unique. And I those kinds of things, I don't know if you remember when Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo were doing the Batman series.
They were yes.
5 issues in, and they did this book that you literally had to turn it 90 degrees every couple pages to follow the action. And I remember I'm sitting there with the book completely turned upside down and reading the book going, this is different, mm-hmm. you know, but I like it when people do things like that. I like, you know, somebody who challenges the way things are done and makes us think and makes us explore things. So I like that a lot. I think that's a great way to do it. So I applaud you for doing that. I think, there's so many standard stuff. Books out there to have something new and different is great.
When you finally do get to, because there is dialogue in the book, you know, mm-hmm. and when you finally get to it, you want to read it and you want to consume it because you know it means something, mm-hmm. You know, because we don't have all this extraneous, just jibber jabber and all this mm-hmm. needless exposition, mm-hmm. You know. We're setting a mood and we're setting a tone and we're trying to draw you into this world and we want you to be fully immersed in it. And we don't want to distract you with words that you don't need, that don't add anything to this world that we're building for you. So when you do hear the characters speak, you know, they have, at least it's my hope that they have their own unique voices and that they, that their dialogue is authentic and in the moment and feels very conversational, but also you feel like it actually is important and that you need to pay attention to it.
Yeah. And the way you start out, the way the story begins is haunting, shall I say. Now, the very first panel, at least on the page that I saw, it's a deserted area, obviously, and there's a church sitting there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is that the it's obviously in the fall or something. There's trees around, but there's no leaves on it and stuff like that. Everything is dark and gray and stuff like that. And this car pulls up, and out comes the person you're talking about. And when we go inside the building, let's just say it's something that we don't expect to see inside of a church building. Let's just say right away, I'm surprised because mm-hmm. I did not expect to see that stuff going on in there.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of surprises going on, and I'm not going to spoil stuff because I got to read it and I got to enjoy what happened as a result of that. So I'm not going to in any way spoil it. The story continues on, let's say, and this is where we meet other characters.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody pulls up in a van, and do you want to talk a little bit about them? I don't want to spoil stuff. If you want to talk about it, I'll feel more comfortable instead if I stumble into something I shouldn't.
Sure. You know, so the character that you were just talking about, that's Agent Brom, Malcolm Brom. He is based, he's inspired by Bram Stoker, you know, kind of an homage to him. And he serves as a framing device throughout the entire story. You know, Bram Stoker's original work was, you know, told mostly through correspondence, people writing letters and notes. And so Brom kind of pulls us through the story as he's investigating what's being called the Cult of Dracula mass suicide event. And that immediately draws us into the world of the cults. You know, I grew up in a small town in Tennessee. And during this time, I remember being very afraid when I was a child of cults, especially around Halloween time and in the fall. You know, the cults were out there and they were going to steal children away and sacrifice them to the devil. And it was a very real, palpable feeling during my childhood. And that's always stuck with me. So I wanted to translate that and tell that story a little bit here in Cult of Dracula. So Agent Brom is investigating that when we begin the story. Mm-hmm. And so after he assesses the crime scene, at the event, we flash back in time 3 days and we see how we got to this event. So we kind of straddle a couple of different timelines as we go through the story. I was probably a little overly influenced by Westworld as I was writing the script, because we do juggle a lot of timelines deeper into the story. Not that there has anything to do with Westworld at all, but just, you know, the kind of timelines working the way they do. So Brahm's story is our framing device. It's the modern day. And then Mina is the protagonist, Mina Murray. She's the protagonist of our past story of how we get to Agent Brom. And so she arrives at the cult compound as part of a documentary film crew from the University of Tennessee. She's a graduate student, studying under, Professor Abraham Van Helsing, who is he was a disgraced priest. He was, you know, thrown out of the priesthood because of something that he did, and he became a college professor, and he's teaching a class on media studies, and Jonathan Harker and Mina Murray happen to be two of his most promising graduate students. And so they arrive. They're going to interview the enigmatic leader of this cult named Robert Renfield. And Renfield is very much inspired by Charles Manson. Mm-hmm. And if you took Charles Manson, Jim Jones, Warren Jeffs, threw them in a blender and cloned what came out, that's, you would probably get Renfield. When I was a child, the two things that scared me the most in the world were Count Dracula and Charles Manson. And so following Stephen King's advice, if you want to scare people, write what scares you. So I wrote a story about Charles Manson and Count Dracula. And so it scares the hell out of me sometimes when I'm writing this down in my office late at night, some of the things where we go with it. So, you know, they're here to interview Renfield and kind of investigate what's going on behind the scenes of his little religious hippie organization, because, you know, there are rumors that there's, you know, that it's not what it seems to be, but they have really no idea how much it's not what it seems to be. They really have no idea what they're getting into. But I think what also makes it very interesting is each one of those characters, they have their own secrets and they have their own personal motivations for being here. No one in the story is who they appear to be. No one is telling the complete truth, and no one is a complete liar. There's a little bit of truth and a little bit of lie and a little bit of motive in everyone. There's no such thing as a black and white, good and evil, villain and hero in this story. There's just people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to spoil stuff, but let's just say the cult leader, there's something noticeable about his face.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to spoil stuff, but let's just say right away, I get the feeling that there's stuff going on let's just say that there's something about his face that surprised me. You know, go with that.
Henry did a wonderful job drawing that from the description I gave him. I gave him, this was actually one of the few things that I only gave him maybe a little, you know, sentence or two description. And when I saw the first, you know, rough pencil sketches, I was like, oh my God, you reached inside my head and pulled that right out. I don't know how you did that, but it's perfect. It's shocking, and it accomplishes exactly what it needs to.
Well, there's one particular feature of his that gets me. It's his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
When he's saying something, there's this look like he's excited and scared at the same time, kind mm-hmm. of a look that I get. So more than that, I'm not going to say, because I want people to get, you know, to get their feelings out when they read the story too.
Those eyes were very important, because when I was a kid, I watched the movie Helter Skelter a lot. And Steve Railsback played Charles Manson. And those eyes to this day haunt me. Like, just talking about them right now, I can see them staring at me. Ooh. So when we were going over our initial character designs, and when we were talking about Renfield, the one thing I told Henry was there are many things that I'm not real concerned about how he looks, but his eyes, they have to be expressive, and they have to have layers, they have to have depth. So I'm really glad that you picked up on that, and that it translates from the art, because there's so much in his eyes, and there's so much going on deep within that character's soul. And Henry does a wonderful job drawing it, and the eyes, he did a masterful job with those.
I can't talk about it, because I lose my ability to speak about it, because it's scary stuff. Really something about it. So, okay, the first issue, you've got, obviously, you're pretty much ready to get the press and come out. You mm-hmm. were talking about early August is when this is going to hit?
Yeah, we're looking at getting it into comic book stores the first week of August, possibly the first week of July, the last week of July, excuse me. Mm-hmm. It probably targeting that first week of August. It's distribution is a little difficult right now with COVID, but the first issue is complete. We actually just got the inks for the A cover today. That was done by Georges Genty. He did a beautiful job with it. He's throwing an homage to Charles Manson in the first cover. If anyone listening is a Manson aficionado or a student of the Manson family, the Tate-LaBianca murders, there are a lot of Easter eggs hidden in Georges's A cover for the book. So we just got the inks for that, sent it over to Trevor Richardson. He's our colorist, does a wonderful job. And the rest of the book's been complete for a while and ready to go to the printer. We're very, very happy that we're going to have three covers for the first book. It's the only book that we're going to do variant covers for. All the rest are just going to be one cover. But the first book, we're going to have the main cover by Georges Genty. And then Georges also did a House of Secrets 92 homage cover for us. That's going to be our B cover. And then Chris Callahan, who is a wonderful artist, very, very hot up and comer, does a lot of cover art. Probably most famous for his work on The Misplaced, which came out through Source Point Press a while back. Chris heard about the book and wanted to be a part of it. So he has agreed to do a special 1 in 50 variant for the book. And we've talked it over. I love his idea for it. It's going to be amazing. So we're going to be sending all that to the printers later on this week and, ready to kick it out to the comic book stores.
And this is going to be bi-monthly, monthly? How's this going to work?
It's going to be monthly. So the first issue is going to hit the shelves first week of August. And then every month after that, until the first five issues are done, then we'll probably take a little bit of a break for a couple of months. Let everybody, people who need to catch up. We're looking at releasing a trade paperback at some point in probably early 2021, and then we'll start volume two shortly after that. Monthly series. So that's pretty exciting.
Does it wrap up by Halloween by any chance?
By Halloween, we're August, September, October. We'll be right in the middle of the book by Halloween. So you're going to the climactic issue three. And I do have to tell you I don't know if I can say curse words on your podcast, but if I can't, bleep me. The shit hits the fan in issue three.
All right. That's in time that's before Halloween though, right?
Yeah. That'll come out probably the week of Halloween. That'll probably hit that Wednesday. So we'll be right there for Halloween Comic Fest, which we're all very excited for. Once you turn the corner in issue three, you're on a roller coaster ride going downhill that you can't stop at that point.
Oh boy. TV show, maybe?
I can't talk about that right now.
Okay. That's a good thing.
What I can tell you is that we have had discussions with some streaming services about adapting the comic book into a streaming series. But beyond that, I really can't say too much more.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing. If you can't talk about it, I'll say that means to me that there might be something good happening.
Yeah.
So that's what we hope for. So more than that, we won't talk about, but that's good. Cause it really is something. It's going to be something to see. Cause like I said, it's unusual. It's new. It's different and it's scary as can be. And I think that, horror people and even people who aren't into horror as much like I'm not usually, I just couldn't stop turning the pages to see what was going to happen.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. And, it has a bit of some of the people who have read it, our focus groups have commented that some parts of it read like a true crime story. So there's a little bit of people have compared it to Mindhunter and the Ted Bundy tapes and things like that, which I think is, if you're following, if Brahms' story resonates with you, then absolutely those stories really pop out to you. It really isn't just a vampire book. It's a cult book, an occult book. It's pagan culture. I have to give a shout out to my dear friend, Whitney Crow, who was kind of my pagan spiritual advisor as I worked on this script. She really advised me on how to handle, pagan culture, very respectfully. And, I'm so grateful to her for that. But there's really a lot of layers to Cult of Dracula, and it really, in some ways, it's kind of a love letter to the horror genre. You know, I'm a huge horror fan. I always have. There's nothing in the world I like better than to be scared. I'm the easiest person in the world to scare because I want to be scared. But then after I'm scared, I laugh and I feel exhilarated and I love it. So, you know, this is a book that I wanted to write for people who love horror. And that, you know, horror encompasses so many different genres and so many different styles. And we tried to paint a very rich tapestry that paid proper homage to each of those. And I really hope that comes through in the final product.
Are there other projects you're working on we should be aware of?
Yeah, you know, we've been talking with Second Sight about working on another horror anthology with Bradley. I've been kicking around an adaptation of a couple of different adaptations. An adaptation of the Frankenstein story. And another completely original story called Shooter that deals with school shootings from a unique perspective. I'm trying to put that one's been a really difficult story to start writing because I have to put myself in a headspace that I don't really want to be in to get in with those characters and this particular character. So I've been avoiding it as much as possible, but I still make the time to work on it. And, you know, I think it's gonna, I think that's something we'll probably see, you know, later on we'll finish it, but we're looking at probably a 5-issue series on that because I like to write shorter stories. I don't really like to write the longer serialized, books because as a comic book fan myself, you know, I just don't like dragging a story out. You know, a story needs to go on as long as it needs to, and the characters live as long as they need to. I just don't want to, you know, drag them around too long.
Now, we've talked about the websites for Second Sight. What about you? If people want to follow you as a creator, how do we do that?
Right now, the best way to do that, you can go to cultofdracula.com. All my information is there. You can also, I highly encourage you to go to the Cult of Dracula Facebook page. It's just Cult of Dracula Comic, and follow us there. We also have a Twitter and an Instagram under the same handle. But the Facebook page is the best way we've found to directly communicate with our fans. And you get a lot of behind the scenes look at what's going on. You know, Henry posts videos of himself drawing different pages, and he talks and, you know, about why he made certain choices, and you get to see original sketches, and you know, you kind of get to see the sausage being made, and you see how there's a really cool post on there that has been viewed thousands of times where we start with my script page that I gave to Henry, and then we show his initial pencil sketch, and then we show my notes back to him, and then how he went back and kind of made adjustments, and then how we applied inks, and then we showed notes with Trevor, our colorist, and how he applied the colors to it, and then you get to see the final product. So you get to see it come all the way from the written word to the colored page, and people have loved being able to see things like that. So our Facebook page, Cult of Dracula Comic, is the absolute best place to get the best info about me and the book and Henry and everything. You know, I should actually probably also mention the other cover artists that we've had on this. Sanford Green from Bitter Root, has done a cover for issue number 3. Carla Cohen from The Boys, Dear Becky, probably her best known work. She is doing a special cover for us. We've already talked about Chris Callahan and, of course, Georges Genty from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Firefly, Gula Nemeth, probably best known for his book Criminal Macabre. He's doing a gorgeous hand-painted cover for issue 2 that is absolutely haunting, and I can't wait to be able to show people that. You know, I've been very blessed and very lucky to work with an extremely talented group of professionals on this book. And I think that speaks to the quality of the idea that people of that caliber are willing to give their time and talent to the project, because if it wasn't worth it, they would not want to be a part of it. They would want to risk their reputation. You know, I think they've put their heart, soul, blood, sweat, and tears into it, just like I have. And it's been a fantastic experience.
That's great. But I'm going to write a review of it when it comes out. So let me know when it's specifically available.
Absolutely.
For people to get, because I write reviews also at Major Spoilers. So
fantastic.
I'll write it.
Yeah, I'll make sure we keep you in the loop on that. For the retailers who may be listening, it went live today on cornerbox.com. So if you want to place your pre-orders for it, it went live today. And then, for, you know, for our fans out there, you know, please contact your local comic book shop first. Ask them if, ask them to order the book, because we always want you to support the local shops first. And, you know, local is what it's all about. And then if you can't find it, you can always go to nirvanacomics.com and order it directly from me there.
Wow. I've got one more question.
Yeah.
Digital, are you going to go digital or are you going to stick to paper?
We're going to go digital. I was insistent that we put it in print first. So it will be available in print form first, and then we'll go to digital with it. So probably a week or two after it hits shelves in print, you'll be able to go and get it on, you know, Comixology and all of the digital sites out there. But we wanted to definitely do everything that we could to support local comic book shops and the local direct comic book shop market first. So that's why we did the very aggressive pricing. $2.99. Every issue is going to be just $2.99. And there's also no ads in the book, which is going to be really cool. Each book will be at least 24 all story pages. A couple of the issues get up to 32 or 36 pages. And then the final issue is probably going to be a giant size issue, because endings are hard and I don't want to end the story. So I just keep writing more and more pages for it. It's going to be an awesome bargain for the reader and an awesome bargain for the retailer as well.
And it's something you might want to hang around, keep around for Halloween and stuff like that. Cause I always like certain things to read certain holidays. And this is going to be one of the ones I'm going to enjoy reading around Halloween once it's all together. So I think it's gonna be a great story. Well, Rich, keep it up. It's a great book. I mean, it surprised and shocked me, and even I have the eyes looking at me right now, and I'm going like, I can feel the shiver going up my spine. So this is going to be one of those great books that I think people are really going to enjoy. So keep it up, and you know, we hope you get to come back and we get to talk some more about some of this good stuff.
I'm happy to come back anytime that you are gracious enough to have me.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always a pleasure to talk with Tyler Chin Tanner from A Wave Blue World. And I want to make sure I get that right, Tyler. Is that right?
You did. You did it perfectly. Nice job.
I mess it up sometimes. So I always
That's the challenge. We don't like to make things easy.
So, and we've talked several times before, so this is a good thing to do. And usually we get together and talk when you've got a good Kickstarter going and you've got another one up right now, which I've already supported. So why don't you tell people what it's all about?
It's called Maybe Someday. It's an anthology about stories of promise and visions of hope. It's a sequel to an anthology we did 2 years ago called All We Ever Wanted. We tend to do anthologies every year for Kickstarter. And the idea is that it's positive sci-fi, like the world will be a better place and that we'll reach a point where things are mostly, you know, good in the world and technology and coming together, society, you know, that sort of thing. So like more Star Trek, less Mad Max has been the comparison.
Because I'm sure you and I have talked before that science fiction, I mean, Star Trek, you mentioned Star Trek. And in the last book, somebody actually said, let's go watch Star Trek. I got a kick out of.
Yes, and, that was in one of the stories. Yeah, Marie Frolics, yes.
Star Trek was something unusual at the time. Star Trek came along with this positive outlook. I mean, if you read science fiction back in the 50s and 60s, it was really dark. Mm-hmm. I mean, things were really, really dark. And here comes Star Trek, which is all bright and shiny. And people glommed onto it. And, you know, darkness kind of faded out. Yeah, but it's kind of come back recently. So I'm glad you're doing something positive with that.
Yeah, you know, I think it goes through cycles, you know, because science fiction can serve as either a warning for where we could end up and what we want to avoid, or, you know, a roadmap or a spotlight on what we can accomplish, you know. So I think depending on just how bad things are and, you know, when things are going pretty well, then the darker stuff serves as a purpose, like don't get overconfident. And then when things just get really bad, you know, then we sort of need the opposite. We need like a light at the end of the tunnel, like you know, it may be bad now, but if we just keep working, keep grinding, you know, we can get there.
Yeah, well, right now is a good time for this, to be honest. Yeah. We the COVID-19 business is there's a light at the end of the tunnel, seems like. We'll see whether that's true or not. And then, of course, I feel bad for the people who are out there. While we're talking, there's a lot of protests and stuff going on. And yeah. I worry because when I look, I don't see them doing a lot of social distancing and stuff like that. So I'm a little worried about that.
I mean, you know, it's hard to do that all. I do see a lot of masks out there.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a start. So well, let's talk about your previous one, though, that All We Ever Wanted. You got a Ringo Award nomination for that, right?
We did, yes. That was really nice. And actually, I went down to Baltimore Comic Con for the Ringo Awards. And I mean, that was so inspiring. That was the first time I'd ever been to like a real awards banquet type thing. And, you know, I guess I didn't really expect too much going into it because I don't know, maybe you just think it's one of these like things where people give awards or whatever, but it was just so inspiring because there's so many generations of comic creators and all these people who made these great books, you know, in the room at these tables with you. And sorry if I'm going off on a tangent here, that was incredible. That was a great experience.
Well, that's good because, the good news is because you've been doing this for a while now. You've been a creator and you're getting to be known among people. And I see you at cons. I saw you at, I think it was Seattle one time. You had a great big booth, which was really great. And I've seen you at other cons as well, too. So you're
Heroes, I'm sure. Yeah.
You're getting noticed. So I think that's a good thing.
I'm getting noticed. I've been around. Yeah. I started the company in 2005, which is actually before my final year at art school. So, you know, I started it right away because I knew I wanted to do my own thing. And then, you know, just, yeah, doing conventions. And I started off pretty small. Not that I'm, like, big now in terms of output. But, you know, rather than doing, like, one title every 3 years, I'm doing more like 6 to 8 titles every year. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, some convention. I mean, Heroes Con, Emerald City Comic Con, those are two of my favorites. Mm-hmm. So I'm there quite often.
Well, that's good. Well, they're kind of comic-centric.
Yeah.
Well, so I remember when I talked to one lady, and I won't mention the con's name, but it's somewhere in Florida. And I asked them, I said, well, what's the percentages? I mean, how many people come for the guests, you know, the TV people, and how many people come for the comics? She said, well, it's about 2/3 for the guests and 1/3 for the comics. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, I said, that's discouraging. I said, you know, some of them are named Comic-Con and they're not the main focus of the convention.
Things have definitely shifted. Like now I go to a convention and like the crowds are bigger, but you don't try to, you know, there's many of them you just kind of have to write off. Like they're not even looking for comics. They just walk past type thing. You know, I've been to shows where it's like, oh, somebody comes by, you try to like talk to them, and you don't even ask them if they like comics, you know, because you assume they do while they're there. You just sort of talk to them about yours. But recently, it's like you're just seeing all these people just zoom past to get their like exclusive toys or autographs, and you just what you end up doing is picking people out, like, oh, I think this is an actual comic book reader, and so forth, and try to bring them to the table. Yeah.
It's so odd because they have Artist Alley, they call it. And I'm always like, shouldn't that be Creators Alley? Because there's a lot of writers and stuff in there too.
Definitely Artist Alley has become writers, small publishers. I've started to move away from that a little bit more, where I was trying to get into like booth spaces and publisher sections. You know, I'm kind of in between depending on the setup, like what would make more sense for me, Artist Alley table or a booth.
It probably depends on the con. Because if you're like Seattle, and they had to cancel it this year, which was really, I was going to get to go to it, darn it. I really wanted to go to, because I love that con. It's Emerald City Comic Con. But the thing about it was, is that, gosh, that is just this massive flow of people going through. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you just put your foot out and get somebody to trip you around to get somebody to look at your stuff.
But, you know, if they're running past, that means they're not even interested, you know. Right. They're trying to get their exclusive toy or whatever.
Yeah, don't waste your time on that.
Yeah.
That's the thing to do. And it's nothing wrong with that. I mean, a convention is an unusual animal. And, you know, someday we're going to figure this whole thing out. But I just don't think we've arrived there yet.
Well, and it's interesting just through the times we're in. We'll see what happens when conventions start to come back online. Which might take a while, especially like national shows, because of just so much of traveling. Even if it's safe for large groups to gather, which will take a while, you still got to factor in all the flying, and people are doing a lot less of that now.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, I got to ask you, as far as with this downtime and stuff, I've seen some stores and some publishers doing like online conventions, they call it, like sales. Mm-hmm. Have you done any of that during this?
I haven't, because when I do a convention, it's really just to get out there and meet people, do some face-to-face, hang out. I don't have a lot of like convention exclusives or prints or special things. It's pretty much just the books with me. You know, I'll put out some graphic novels. So essentially, I can just go out there and be like, anything that I try to sell you is in my web store. You know, I've got our 20 books or whatever that's in there. So I'm trying to be around online. I did that deal on my website where if somebody buys something from my web store and tells me what comic shop they would have bought that from, I will send that store half of the price, you know, half the profit. Just because that's what, like, you know, that sale would have been, to try to help the stores. And, you know, that's kind of one thing that I'm doing to get out there and adjust for the current situation. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're still figuring out what we're going to be when we grow up. When all this So we're going to work on it. So let's get to the book, because I think we should. Oh, in fact, I'm looking, your amount just went up some. Well, the goal is $25,000.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the specifics are, it's going to conclude Thursday, July the 2nd at 5 p.m. Eastern time. Mm-hmm. And you've got to reach that amount. Now, we're talking early in the campaign, and I've already contributed. And there's plenty of time to go, but, you know, the old daily heart attack business, you know, you log on and nobody pledged that day, and you kind of go, oh, no, is it over, you know, kind of stuff. But I don't think you have to work, because you've done a lot of these. And you've been.
Yeah, this is my sixth one. So wow. I've been through it all. Yeah. And the thing that I always say with the Kickstarter campaigns is there's no like proper pace to it. You know, it's not like you don't break it down by days and by hours and be like, I got to raise this much type thing, because it all comes in waves and attention and momentum and things like that. So you definitely want to start off strong. And that's what we've been doing, you know, and we've, for our first day, you know, we have, looking like right now, we have 203 backers, and we're just over 25% funded. So, I mean, that's a quarter of the way in for only being one out of 30 days. So that's good. But I mean, that's what you want to do, because we're not going to keep up this momentum, because obviously we made a big splash. Like, we went live and we got the news sites to cover it and things. So, you know, I could never really say like, okay, you know, we're doing great or something, because, you know, at some point it will slow down and most people that we've reached will have heard of it. Mm-hmm. And we'll just have to just keep on chugging along. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm really, it's been a fun day. We've been doing great. No complaints whatsoever.
Because we're recording it.
They went.
Yeah, we're doing it on the first day, just so people know. It's going to post on Sunday. And by then, hopefully your numbers just went up again. Every time I look at it.
Oh, you're really watching. Monitoring.
Yeah, well, I've got it in front of me. And all of a sudden it goes pop, the number goes up. And I'm going like, whoa, okay. Maybe I should watch that a lot. Because every time I look, mm-hmm. it goes up a little bit. So that's a good thing. But it's a great thing to, I think that Kickstarter is one of those things that makes comics happen these days, especially if you're not DC or Marvel. You know, you've got to raise funds to do it, and it's possible. But, you know, okay, you said this is number six for you. What kind of things are you doing differently now than when you started?
Well, I mean, a lot, because you learn a lot. A lot of prep work before you launch the campaign. You know, it used to be a bit more that you would launch the campaign when you had the idea and you're like, oh, I would love to do this project. Let's, you know, put it on Kickstarter and hope it gets funded and then we'll make it type thing. Whereas now we're really committing to it and starting the process and, you know, putting the anthology, and we've got the cover and the logo and we've got all the stories in, and now we're getting the artwork in because we want things to show. We want to show people like, hey, this is really happening. This is going to look great. You know, you're really going to get it. You know, talk to the news outlet sites and be like, here's what we've got going on. Give us some coverage, because that helps a lot. You know, I was able to reach out to Newsarama and Bleeding Cool and show them pages and be like, here, I want these pages to show. You know, and they do that. And so a lot more is done before the Kickstarter launches. And then the plan is to have it out relatively soon, to have it out in November. Okay. We could probably have it out even before that, but we actually have built in more of a marketing window as well, too. So we'll put a book together, get it to the distributors, and do like a full-on marketing cycle. So yeah, just a lot more planning, a lot more organizing, just getting your ducks in a row. That's really what it comes down to, and that's what I've learned over the time.
Yeah, it's really something, because, you know, I have seen Kickstarter where somebody says, hey, I got this idea, give me $5,000 and I'll make it happen.
And yeah, you got to have a realistic goal. Which,
well, not only that, what are you going to do with the money? I mean, you know, the people say, I got this idea, give me $5,000 and I'll do it. You know, most people, luckily, won't support that kind of thing, because, you know, you have to kind of prove that you know what you're doing and that money is going to be well invested.
Yeah. I mean, ideas are cheap, you know, that's the thing, like with Kickstarter gives you funding, you know, it's not going to like help you make it happen. You have to know how to do that yourself, you know?
Yeah. You're really good at this. The thing, I know you and I talk about this every time, but I think it's worth repeating that, you know, anthologies are not something that a lot of people do these days. And yet you do it very successfully. And I think that's something that I need to point out, because, I mean, I used to love anthologies. You know, DC has these 100-page giants now, but they're printing old material. It's not new stuff. Your book is entirely new.
And yeah, you know, it's all brand new stories.
But now you've gotten, you know, used to it. You know how to organize this whole stuff by now, because you do these once a year. And, you know, we've talked a little bit in the past about how you get creators together and to do stuff and those kinds of things. But why don't you real briefly talk about how you do that? What is it? How do people get involved in your anthologies?
Well, we do it through curation. We reach out to people that based off of what we've seen them doing. And sometimes, I mean, it's veterans, but it's new people. You know, we have our eyes on like, all right, new emerging creators. They have to have been putting stuff out. But it could be their own stuff they did through Kickstarter, an independent comic they published, or in a very small press. But we try to get a good mix of people that we feel fit with what we're trying to do. And we invite them. We explain the concept. You give them deadlines and the format, and you just get people working, get them excited, and get them going on it.
And 25 stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of storytelling.
It is. It's over 50 creators. It's a lot of wrangling.
That's what, of course, you have two editors that work with you, right?
Yeah, Matt and Eric. Yep.
Yeah, Eric, who I've interviewed on this podcast before, whose stuff I always enjoy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I haven't talked to Mike, I don't think, or Matt before, so I'll have to talk with him at some point and stuff too.
Sure, but yeah.
Are you kind of the overseer and they're kind of the people who make things happen? Are they the on the ground people and you're kind of the overlooking, oh, this needs to get done. You know, the plate is starting to wobble over there. Have you ever seen the people have plates on sticks kind of stuff?
I mean, I'm definitely coming at it from more of the publisher standpoint where, you know, I am involved in the stories and checking things over. Yeah, they're more of the front lines with dealing with the creators. They reached out to them and was like, all right, let's get these stories in and did a little bit more of that discussion with the concepts. And then when the art comes in, you know, I start to get, well, I'll read the scripts once they're in and work with the artist and make sure they know the template and the deadlines and the process, like who's inking it, coloring it, so forth. So yeah, I provide a little bit more of the structure side of things where maybe they're more of the relations side of it. You know, I mean, an editor is a very broad term in the comic book industry, as you know. I mean, it can be from, you know, copy editing to organizing the project, you know, and bringing it all together. So, you know, we just split it, you know, we little passing back and forth, little just here are the different lanes, you know, you do this, I'll do that. But it's been a very successful process. This is our third one with the three of us. So yeah, we're getting better at it and we enjoy the process and great books are the result. So
yeah. Now, I've got to ask, of course, being an editor myself, I always am curious, how do you keep coming up with new story ideas? You know, 25 stories, and each one of these has, what, 25 in it, pretty much, roughly. I mean, as you keep coming up, of course, there's a lot of creativity going on, and maybe this is a non sequitur question, but, I mean, is it, you kind of keep on the lookout for something that repeats itself, or you're looking for new stuff all the time. How do you do that from a broad perspective?
Yeah, that's one reason why we talk to the writers first about the concepts. Like we want to have that. We don't just say, hey, turn in a script. We want to make sure we're just not, you know, going over the same ground. There will be some, because of the theme, there'll be some similarities, which is fine. But as long as I don't know, everything has its own bent to it, slightly different. And sometimes we'll point something out and just be like, okay, we like your idea. There's another story that's doing something like this, you know, do you maybe change this part of it a little bit? But there really hasn't been too much issue. And you know, and creators themselves are so different that even if you have things that are sort of similar, you know, the way the artists draw or even the way the writers write it, it's going to end up being very different. And so, you know, even with the 25 stories in the first one and the 25 or more in this one, they've all been very original, had their own sort of perspective. And yeah, I think that it all comes together really well.
And then too, you're mixing writer with artist, and that combination might be new and different, and something different will come out of that combination. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah. I know from working with different artists that, yeah, you feel almost like you've got this different style to your story. They don't come out the same when you have different artists working on it. You're just like, oh, okay, this is how this one's working with this collaboration. All right, good. You know, it just gives you some more variety, your story. So as a writer, you don't feel like you're putting out the same things all the time.
That's good. Well, some of the names I know and some of them I don't. And that's one of the things I like about anthologies is I get exposed to people that I don't necessarily know much about yet. Some of them I do. And I got to mention some of the ones that I already know. Phil Seavey to me is one of the best. Philip just does one of some of the best stuff out there, in my opinion. He's just doing wonderful books. And he does both sides, too. He does the writing and the art.
Is what yes. Yeah. Yeah. He had just had a triage was one of the things he just came up with.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I love that book. That was such a wonderful book. And of course, the female lead stuff. You win me over every time when you do that, as you know, because you had a story, I think, with a female lead in it, too, that I really liked. So
yeah, and All We Ever Wanted, 17 Souls. I'm actually revisiting it. It's the only sequel within the sequel. Really? My story, 17 Souls.
Interesting. Well, that's going to be fun.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting to read that. I think it's going to be great to do. Steve Niles, of course, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And as I quickly looked down, Rod Reiss, I know. I've seen his stuff. Daniel Kibblesmith. Other ones in there. Jeff Edwards. All these ones I know. But there's other – I know Joe Caramagna, but I've only seen him. And interesting, he used an illustration from the DuckTales in there because that's where I largely know his stuff. Stephanie Phillips is really good too. I've talked with her. She does good stuff.
Yeah, she's been doing some great stuff the last couple of years.
Kirk Pyers, I know. These other ones I don't know. And that the good thing for me is I'll get to know these people. I'll get to see some of their stuff, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, it's going to be great fun to see how these people do stuff.
And the story. I mean, that's what's fun about an anthology, right? You get exposed to so much more work than you might normally, just picking up a graphic novel by the same creative team.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be great fun. I mean, do you intentionally mix the creative teams up, or is that – do they – say who they want to work with? How does that work out?
We leave that pretty open. I mean, as we start collecting both writers and artists, we'll see, like, maybe a writer we want to work with has a suggestion for an artist. And we try not to be like, because I always work with this artist, but it might be like an artist they know of that they've always wanted to work with. So we'll take that into consideration, or, you know, the artist might say the same thing. So we'll see as things come together, we sort of mix and match if we need to, or bring somebody on based off of a recommendation.
Now, there's some of the stories we see pages on the Kickstarter page. And by the way, you look for, of course, as we've said, maybe someday. So you want to look that up and go there. But some of the art, I want to talk about the Kickstarter cover, which I really like. It's really great. Of course, our female leads win me over every time. There's a woman on what looks to be like I don't know how to describe it. A spaceship that's got a flag on it, and it's got space dolphins going by.
Yeah, it's like a high tech windsurfer type vehicle. Yeah,
who did that?
It's a pretty great image.
Who did that?
Max Dunbar was the line artist, and then Espen Grundichen. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce the colorist's last name, but they teamed up on it.
That's the bad news about the internet stuff. We get names that we don't know how to pronounce.
Yeah.
And there's no guide on how to do it either.
Now, well, I work with people and I'm like, I still don't know how to say that person's name because I just email with them.
That's right. Because you don't physically talk with them. Many times when I'm doing an interview, I have to say, now, how do you pronounce your name? I want to get it right somehow. Now, there are pages from some of the stories. And maybe what I'll do is I'll mention them and you can kind of give a little bit of a talk about what it's about.
Sure.
Put you on the spot here. One that we see is called Droplets.
Yes.
What's the story about droplets?
So those are about people, astronauts or whatever, you know, this future that seek out other worlds that don't have life on them. Presumably, you know, these people are looking for habitable planets, and they're sort of shot out in this sort of isolated space to find new worlds and make these new worlds. So this droplets, meaning like things that they come to plant and make these worlds habitable again. They're armed with these staffs that you'll see on that page to sort of bring life to desert world and just be like, there's just two of them out in that world. Well, I don't know that you can see that from that first page there. You know, and they're like, all right, two of us in this big, big old world, and we're going to, you know, bring life and repopulate this planet. And just that idea of being very small droplets in a big, big new world.
That's kind of interesting because, you know, obviously you can see that they're spreading them out across the world and they have to physically go along and like puncture each one to get open, which is kind of interesting. It's that's not very spacey, you know. Usually you see like they'll shoot them out and they'll just automatically pop open, but for them to actually have to physically go along and open them up, that's kind of makes that a little more interesting, I think, of a story. So that'll be fun.
Yeah it was really good. And that's you can see there, Isaac Goodhart did the art, and that he's great. I didn't know him that well before this Kickstarter campaign, but yeah, what a phenomenal artist. And Connor Knudsen did the writing.
Very nice. And now, To Wish Impossible Things by Matt Miner and Rod Reiss.
Yeah.
What's that about?
I mean, this one I'm trying to remember. I read his so long ago because Matt had it done. It's like some kid finds a time traveling machine in his room or something like that, and goes to the future and I'm trying to remember what exactly the crux of it, but yeah, you know, time travel to a time where the future is wonderful, and you know, it's sort of an encouragement to a young boy struggling in our timeline where things don't look like they'll get any better, to see that hope. And that's why it's called To Wish Impossible Things.
Yeah, very cool. I like the name of it. That's great stuff. So let's see. Let me get the next one going here. What is there another one that pops out to you right away?
Well, the next one, Alice in Wonderland, is a great story. That's by one of the other editors, Eric Palicki, and Sally J. Jane Thompson did the art for it. That's one of the ones that's not so much futuristic as... we opened up to this idea of fantasy or an alternate reality, you know, a little bit to the left of ours. This is a play on Alice in Wonderland, but this is Alison Wonderland. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just about a world that's a little bit different, and it's a really cool.
I like the purple bear. That purple bear, I like to see. That's going to be fun to see. And then the next one's called The Heroic Truth, and the illustration. It's really interesting. Is that Nick Pyle doing that illustration?
Yeah, Nick Pyle is a great artist. I don't know that he's done a lot of comics, but he has a lot of great work on Instagram. I don't know if he just mostly does illustrations or something specific, but wild artwork. Looks great. Really cool to have him in there. And Aubrey Sitterson, who just had a big smash hit. I think Dark Horse published it. No One Left to Fight. It was a really cool series. Great to have them on there as well.
That's going to be interesting. Do you remember what that story is about by any chance?
Oh, I don't. I wish I could. Man, I read 28 of these scripts, and some of them were several months ago.
Well, the art's very dazzling, too. I mean, you know, it's easy to get distracted by the art because it really gets you. Heroic Truth, I imagine something is going on, and we're trying to figure out what the truth is. So I imagine on the title looks pretty good. So, yeah, those are ones.
I get like these vague memories. Like, I do remember reading it, and I'm sort of remembering, but I mean, not enough to really wrap my head around an explanation.
There'd be a question. There'd be a quiz here on this thing, so I told you ahead of time so you could study up for the those kinds of things. But because the illustrations are kind of fun. One of the nice things about the illustrations is you get to see their work, mm-hmm. and it doesn't necessarily have to do with the story as much as it's their art and stuff, which is kind of fun to see. Like I said, and some of the names that I don't know that are really interesting. I don't know Christopher Mitten. So I'm going to be interested to see that.
Oh, yeah, working on Steve Niles' story. I don't know his resume, but I mean, I think he's done mostly mainstream stuff. I've seen he just turned in the pencil pages for the story. So they look great. They look up real fast.
Interesting.
I find him on Instagram now, too.
There's all kinds of wonderful stuff in there. Now, how many stories did you write? Because your name's in there a couple times.
I was just one of the editors, and I wrote one story. I write a story for each of my anthologies. So,
good. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
And
stuff,
like I said, mine is my story is actually a sequel to the one that I had in All We Ever Wanted. So it was neat to be able to do that.
That's going to be interesting to see because I'm not used to sequels. Usually, especially in science fiction, they tend to Brave New Worlds is to be funny about that, and we want to go where we haven't been. It's like the new Star Trek. It's Strange New Worlds. I want it to be Strange New Worlds. Don't go to where we've been before. Go someplace new is what I'm begging for because I've seen even when the Enterprise was around, we went to where we saw the Borg, we saw Ferengi, all this kind of stuff. I was going like, oh, we've been there already. Let's go somewhere new. Mm-hmm. And that's the fun thing about your stuff is we often go places into situations we haven't explored before. And I always find that interesting. I always find that fascinating. I want to see stuff I haven't seen before, doggone it. The bad news is I've been a reader for decades. And so to get one past me or go that I haven't seen before,
work. You've seen all the tricks, huh?
Yeah, I've seen all the little things. And I go, oh, okay, here we go. This is where this happens and that happens. And you know, so for me, that's one thing I like about yours. Yours tend to be really creative and original stories going on. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point of it. We want to put something out, not because we're trying to rehash anything or do fan fiction. I mean, that's what we look for is original stories, people that, only those creators would tell.
Mm-hmm. Josh Hood is a name I'm not familiar with. Alejandro Aragon, I'm not familiar with that either. I'm sure I will be once I read this thing. I'm interested. So there's all kinds of really interesting stuff to this question. You know, just because the illustrations on there that teases me to think, oh, it's going to be a story. There's one, Staladia does one that has a ship on it. And I'm going, is that a ship story? And I imagine, no, that's probably just that person's art.
Yeah. The creator slugs that are on the page are just showing things they have done before.
Yeah, that'd be good. So this is going to be, I think you're well on your way to getting that goal, and I think that's going to happen. And again, July 2nd, Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We got to make sure you get the goal by there so that we can get this done. And you're saying you expect this to be done by when?
We're going to put it out in November. Like, we're all, like, set. I think all the – I mean, the deadline we have is the end of July for the creators. So, I mean, August, we'll wrap it up, send a print, you know, through September, October, and, you know, boom, it'll be out in November, just in time for the holidays to lift people's spirits.
Well, it looks great. I mean, all the stories sound interesting, and the artwork looks great. Very creative. Like I said, the guy with the little balls that pop around, he's got to go around and pop each one to get the things to go. I find that really an interesting story to go, something different, because, you know, that's more fantasy along in my mind than in science fiction. Mm-hmm. But that's good. I want to see variety. I want to read things like that. I want to read different kinds of stories. So for me, that's fascinating to me. I'm just dying to see. And of course, the guy is, if it's a guy, I don't know if that's a guy or a girl, but maybe it's a woman going around with the staff, and then she's got like what looks to be like nature.
I think it's a male character, as I remember the script. Yeah.
But, and it's got a green, of course, you know, of course, you're putting little balls with green flowery or plant life in it and stuff. So show a connection between the person and the thing that he's doing, which is kind of cool. So all that's just, I'm going to be fascinated to see how this all goes. Now, do the story lengths, do they vary? I mean, how many pages, is there a standard page number for a story? How much does it change up?
We try to get people to do 4 to 8 stories. Sometimes you'll get a short one at like 2. Sometimes someone will go over to 10, but we try not to, we try to keep it in that 4 to 8 range, just so that like one isn't like too long or too short.
Do you get posters in there too?
No, it's all pretty much story, sequential art. Every once in a while we'll get like a pin up in the back or something like that. But I mean, it's mostly about the stories.
The more I look at it, the more questions I have.
we'll have a look there. That's ask questions.
This is going to be November. This is going to come. So this is a good thing if you're aiming for a holiday gift for somebody who's a comic.
Exactly.
Person,
right? Yeah.
This is just going to be ideal for that. And it gets you some of your shopping done early, which is a good thing to do. So this is going to probably keep you busy for a lot of this year. What about the future, to talk about that? What other projects do you have coming? Does your company have, and do you have coming?
We have a lot of stuff planned up that I'm pretty excited. And now we plan so far ahead too, because of the way the publishing world works and marketing and selling to bookstores and libraries. You got to have like full review copies ready to go and market for a while. So we're going to continue doing our anthology each year. We actually probably going to be doing 2 next year, one that will kickstart and one that we'll just do, you know, without the campaign. We've also got some sequels coming out, books that we've put out. We've announced a sequel to Dead Legends, which was our kung fu action flick, graphic novel series. We did Mezzo, which is the one that I wrote, which is the Mesoamerican inspired fantasy. We're doing another one of those, and the 27 Run, which is the monster versus mech. And then we'll actually be doing some YA next year too. I can't tell you the titles, but we're going to get into YA and middle grade a bit more, some literary adaptations. We have Phantom of the Opera coming out this fall, and then we've got some more planned in the future. So some pretty neat stuff that we're doing. We're not growing super big, but, you know, 8 to 10 projects each year, so there'll be some good things coming out.
I just said, while you were talking, your number went up again on me. So
I'm just going to have you send me reports, Wayne. Can you do that? You watch it for me and just tell me how it's going.
So I'll have to watch. I'll have to say, oh, one up to this. Oh, another one. But it's kind of fun. It's interesting you mentioned young adult because I'm getting into that kind of stuff. DC's doing a series of young adult stuff that are really
good. Yeah, they've had some great books. The Mara one, the Catwoman one.
Yeah.
I think a Wonder Woman just came out, which I haven't had a chance to get yet.
Yeah, there's a Dick Grayson one that I haven't gotten to yet. There's bunches of good things. You have a couple Batman ones. We even had like a Batman who is somewhat diverse with some Asian blood mixed in with them, which was kind of
heavy. I think I did see something post online about that. Yeah, but I didn't get that.
That was a good one.
But yeah, for me, you know, it's funny. When I got into comics, I was, you know, the idea was, all right, I'm going independent. I'm going to be breaking boundaries and I'll follow the rules. I mean, which is all well and good, but I realized that it was like mostly adult stuff. And as kids, comics have been getting more popular again and kids have been getting to it. I was getting kind of tired of being at shows and being like, kids would come by and be like, have anything for my young child? And I'd be like, no, actually they can't. They can't read this one. This one has swears and nudity, this and that. And I was like, well, I mean, I really like the idea of getting the new generation interested in comics, and I have stories that I would love to tell to the young readers. So,
if we're going to have a future, we've got to start getting people when they're younger get into reading. Cause for a long time games took over for, kids didn't read, they played games and video games. And I was always like, I don't have time for that stuff, but I'd love to read. I was brought up that way. And so for me, when I see, I can't remember the exact name of the book, Dog Man or Dog Boy or something. It's this huge book that's just selling like crazy. And I'm going like, I've never even seen it. But you know what? That's a good, it's like Harry Potter, right? If kids are going to read it, I'm all for it, man. Go right ahead. Have fun reading and do those kinds of things. Because, maybe as you start to read that, you look for other things to read and that'll draw them into reading this stuff. That's why I think the cover, I think, is going to be really cool and really inviting for people on this one as well. Yeah. It's going to be
covers great. Are important for sure.
Well, I always say that the art attracts people, but the story keeps them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I look at it. So I think that cover is just going to work perfectly for your book. I used to think that maybe someday cover is gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. It's great.
Really good stuff. So, so let's say people want to keep up with what you're doing. We've talked about this before, but it always helps to update people. As far as social media goes, where can we go as far as like your company and then your stuff?
Well, A Wave Blue World. So, just A Wave Blue World. And we find that on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. My name is Tyler Chintanner. So I usually have accounts just by that name. Our website is awbw.com. Just looking for that stuff. I'm out there by name. I don't have any weird handles or anything.
Okay. But you got a hyphen in there. That Chintanner is hyphenated. I always tell people because sometimes some browsers are funny that way and you don't put a hyphen in there. It says, oh, that's not it. So we got to make sure that people understand that.
I'm like Spider-Man, it's got a hyphen in. Don't forget the hyphen.
You'd be surprised how many people don't put the hyphen in Spider-Man. Does it?
Shame on them.
This is the bad news when you're an editor. I can't help myself. I'll be sitting watching television. I always tell the story. I'll be sitting with my friends, and all of a sudden this commercial will come on. I go, oh, no, they spelled refrigerator wrong. And my friends look at me like, what? But I can't turn that stuff off. It doesn't mean I get everything, but I do see some stuff. So I'm always trying to catch those things. And that's why, I especially when it comes to the internet, you got to kind of be precise when you're looking for stuff. So I try to get all those good things. So I think you're off to a good start, Tyler, as always. And I think this is going to be great. And we got to keep track of your stuff so that we can talk again. And I'm sure this is going to be a big success. Do you have any plans for maybe another follow-up to this in the future?
Well, we'll definitely keep doing the anthologies. I think the anthologies each year work pretty nicely. Like I said, maybe even two. I don't know whether we'll do a third of this. It just seems to me like, I don't know. We'd have to change the theme a little bit to not just be like, and 25 more positive visions of the future. Like, I'm sure people will still want uplifting stories, but maybe we'll tweak the theme to do something that's I don't know. We'll have to come up with that. But yeah, but definitely expect quality anthologies coming from us for years to come.
So you won't do the dark future stuff?
Well, who knows? I mean, if we solve everything, if we solve all our problems in the next year, people will be like, I know, I want to read about the dark future. We're like, all right, well, then we'll do that. We have trust us. If we things are looking better, we'll be happy to do that.
And I'm sure you'll do it well. So that's never going to be a problem with that. So Tyler, as always, your stuff is always great. You guys do a wonderful, good book. Say hi to Eric for me when you see him, because I always say hi to him when I see him at cons and stuff like that, because I always like his stuff.
Well, that might be a while, but I'll send him a message.
Well, you know, I'll have to send him an email at some point. Say, yeah, hey, for sure. You might remember me. I talked with you once. But we'll do those kinds of. But yeah, just keep it up, Tyler. And always, always, always great stuff. Again, it's Maybe Someday. Go to Kickstarter. Be sure to get out there right away, because help Tyler, you won't sweat so badly about the future. And we got to get it in by Thursday, July the 2nd, again, by 5 p.m. And I'm just convinced we'll get there. So keep it up, Tyler. And we'll have to talk again when the next things are coming around.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great to talk to you as always, Wayne. We'll do more in the future.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.